Chapter 13. While Hank and Joe Lee were waiting for the start of the movie, they stared out into the playground that was set up at the base of the screen. Joe Lee gazed at Hank's profile and saw a softness in his gaze as he watched the children. She wondered what a child of theirs would look like. She took her yellow page fingers and twisted them in the hair above his temples. Dangling in front of her eyes was Shirley Temple singing "On the Good Ship Lollipop." She stared down disapprovingly at his glasses and thought that maybe they might have a blind child, and that frightened her. Suppose he went blind and she got stuck taking care of him. Hank was smoking a cigarette and quietly letting Joe Lee play with his hair. He knew that this was the way life was supposed to be. He had been slightly concerned about whether the car speaker would be broken or fuzzy. But by now, not even an essential like that was even more than a detail. They tickled each other and laughed when the movie started. They pointed towards the screen like they were visiting a zoo. Hank became interested in the plot, while Joe Lee grew bored and decided it was one of the stupidest movies she'd ever seen. She wondered what Hank could be thinking about while they were watching this thing. She liked the title, but the people were all the same. There was no monster, no action, none of the things she liked in a good story. She reached for Hank's hand. It was so dark now that they could go any place. She said, "I feel like there are people breathing all around here." Suddenly, the weight, mass, and sweat of the palpitating crowd oppressed Hank like he was locked in a closed closet in August. He took the speaker off the window and asked where she wanted to go. At first, Joe Lee couldn't believe that he was doing it. She had never walked out of a movie in her life, except for the time when she was in the balcony with Dennis Wirth. She had been jerking him off, and then there was a power failure, and everyone had been given passes to come back whenever they wanted. She hadn't liked the drive-in, but it gave her a strange feeling in the pit of her stomach that she just said that she didn't like it, and he was ready to go. They turned onto the highway, and she said, "Hank, can we get dinner?" Hank had $60 in his pocket and didn't care how much of it he came home with. His mind scaled a list of blue ribbon restaurants he constructed for just such a purpose. How about a seafood place called the Fin and Claw? He suggested in a smooth Jonathan Schwartz reading a commercial voice. At dinner, they smiled over and over again at how good everything tasted. They drank 2 bottles of red wine. They talked about actors and movies that Hank never told anybody about. He knew no one else that liked Fred Astaire, even though Fred made Mick look like a man who was afflicted with a disease of the nervous system. For the first time that he could remember, he allowed himself to be critical of rock music. Sure, he had Ron talked about how Jagger was nothing but a prick who fucked up everybody's head and took their money to boot. But that was said with admiration, laced with envious laughter. "I think Mick Jagger is a lazy slob who's done nothing with his talent except create absolute shit," said Hank. Joe Lee was thinking about a fantasy she once had about giving Mick a blowjob while he stood on stage and sang Jumpin' Jack Flash. Why do you think that? She asked. He just hasn't changed, and it's getting harder and harder to find something about their songs that isn't dull. So, who do you like now? She knew that he wanted to talk and decided to let him run along what he would consider a wonderful conversation, during which she would say little or offer no opinion. It was the way most men and boys liked it. Hank opened his musical heart to Jolie's scrutiny. She listened with an expression of studied interest. He was totally oblivious to the fact that she didn't care about rock music at all. She wondered why men drew women into useless confidences. She studied his cheekbones as the subject came around to San Francisco groups like Quicksilver Messenger Service, a great band that could reach stardom if they could find a distinctive vocalist, someone who would jump out at you like one of the instruments instead of just going along. Jolie decided that there was something about Hank's face that reminded her of an embryo. He had moved on to talk about Jefferson Airplane, and she giggled at the thought of an embryo with glasses. She scratched his sideburns, and Hank thought that he must be impressing her with what he knew. They each drank brandy after dinner. Then, at Jolie's suggestion, they moved to the bar, and he had gin gimlets. Hank liked the alliteration in the phrase and had taken to repeating it as often as he could. Long after his words began to slur, he told her about how Ron was always putting people down if they drank too much. Jolie really didn't care for Ron, and by the fifth or sixth time his name had come up, she was openly hostile. Don't you see that he only criticizes to make himself feel better? Hank was stunned. He had never noticed what was now an obvious thing. He liked the way Jolie had just pinpointed it. They were very drunk when they reached the parking lot. Jolie was enjoying leaning against him while they moved. She walked up to his side of the bug and said sneakily, "I want to get in this way." Hank knew immediately that she'd forgotten about the gear shift. It made him bite down on his lip and think about his Chevy. "Found that your son was as clean as the driven snow," explained Detective Gavin L., slowly giving the phone the finger as he shook his head and said, "Of course I would have let him call home if there was ever a question about us holding him." A pause. "Yes, Mrs. Bombasco, I would be our duty to let you know if anything had really been wrong." Marjorie again mentioned her connection with Judge Matheson, and Gavinell's face tightened the same way it had when his chief had told him that he should call the woman up and smooth things over after the chief had listened to her mention the judge's name several times during their conversation. The chief had been right on the mark when he told Gavinell that his actions had been 200% in the right, but he was requesting that Gavinell make the call so that Judge Matheson wouldn't have to listen to this woman complain for the next 20 years. Gavinell had been around long enough so that the chief didn't have to say another word. He concluded the mission by repeating that the department was sure that Ron was as clean and pure as the driven snow. Marjorie said that she would accept the apology, but that she thought the police could find better things to do than harassing innocent people. Gavinelle thanked her, put down the phone, exchanged a disgusted look with Sergeant Brady, and walked out dramatically, wringing out his ear with his finger. By the next morning, Ron was beginning to feel good about having endured the situation in the police department. He had been waylaid by the enemy and kept his cool. He had broken free with the logic of the situation, demanding his release. When Marjorie told him about her conversation that morning with the chief of police and then Gavinelle, he looked at her with contempt. He swallowed down 2 hard rolls and 1.5 cups of coffee. He kept his eyes open and silently repeated to himself that he had a real date that evening and that this was a good time to ask about the car again. Marjorie finished telling him about what Gavinelle had said and asked if he would go out and get some breakfast cake. "Sure," said Ron. "Couldn't you call Jerry's wife and make plans to ride in their car tonight? This is a really pretty girl, and do you know how long it's been since I've had a date?" "Weeks." "Oh, you poor thing," said Marjorie, smiling. "Come on," he said, returning him a smile. "Now you're going to laugh at me? I'll see what I can do." By the time George came to the table, Ron was back with the buns. George usually drank his coffee without saying anything. She never criticized him for being quiet in the morning, since she was usually quiet herself. He was pleased to find that Ron had included some apple turnovers in the sack. They were his favorite, and he was the only one who ate them. He placed them on his napkin, sweetened his coffee, poured the milk in the same orderly fashion that always gave him some sense of satisfaction. He had taken about 3 bites of the turnover when Marjorie asked, "Aren't they good, George?" He didn't quite say yes, but he nodded in assent. "George," she began. He stopped eating with a frozen look and waited for what was coming. "Why don't we see if we can use their car tonight? We couldn't really go out in their new car just as easily. I'm sure Jerry would like us to go for a ride in it." "Go ahead," droned George in a defeated voice that didn't want the day to start with an argument. Ron headed to empty the garbage in appreciation. He hadn't bought books, and that meant he had almost $30, which gave him about $10 to fuck around with at Wellmont. As he took the garbage out the back door, he saw Jerry's old car, the new car, parked by the garage. He had forgotten all about it. From this angle, he couldn't see any dents at all. He put the garbage down beside the open cans and went to have a look at it. As the back of the car came into view from behind the hedges, he saw the shot it had taken. Ron thought that it must have been hit by a pointy-nosed thing. He checked the gas tank and saw that it was solid and in place. The car sat up straight. There was this huge needle-nosed gash that pushed its trunk about a third of the way in. The steering wheel was a big silver thing, not like anything the tight leather wheel of his Catalina. Everything else checked out fine, and the hood had these 2 silver tips that he knew he would like guiding the car by. George was reading the morning paper when Ron came back into the house. "The car looks really good," he said. Never try to tell you anything, said George. He stood up and folded the paper under his arm. Then he turned and headed for the bathroom. He's right, said Marjorie. You always give him a hard time, and this time he's right, she repeated with emphasis. What do you want me to do? Stick around and give him a hand once in a while. He never has any help when he tries to do anything. George stopped reading his paper and listened. He smiled with the knowledge that at least his wife took his part sometimes. But he was only able to make out every third word that she said. Hank, your father and I want to talk to you before you go out. Just for a few minutes, she added, with a reassuring nod of her soft double chin. Hank stared down at his nails and then strapped on his thick leather watch band. He was walking with a hop in his step and was sure that he was just missing bouncing off the ceiling. He found them at the kitchen table, watching him with an avid curiosity. They always acted like something was wrong with him. They were like a comedy act when they tried to talk to him, phony as the way I used to recite the Pledge of Allegiance, he thought to himself. He sat down opposite them. His eyes stared back at them. His face was expressionless. Hank, began his father, we're worried about where you're going all night. We know that you're keeping company with a girl. And now your mother tells me that you didn't want to say where you were going the other day. We feel it's our duty to advise you not to do anything that you'll regret. You've got your whole life in front of you, Henry. Hank's father leaned forward with an open grin on his face. Have fun with her, but don't screw yourself up. Hank's mother shifted her bottom nervously around the chair, the way that showed she'd been made uncomfortable. Hank grimaced when his father stopped talking and sarcastically asked her if anything was wrong. She looked at him coldly, then turned to her son, sadly said, we just don't want you to make any stupid mistakes. The world is filled with nice girls. Hank grimaced. No matter how hard he tried, he knew his mother would never like Jolie. He'd known that before, and now he realized why it bothered him. Things were going to be just that much more difficult now. His parents both had sympathetic expressions plastered on their faces. Hank knew that it wouldn't be necessary to say anything to them. He sat there for 3 or 4 minutes, clasping and unclasping his watch band, while they looked at him. When he felt that he'd shown them that he contemplated their words for a decent interval of time, he asked if there was anything else that they wished to discuss with him. He watched them shake their heads and look at each other gravely. He started for the door. His father followed him onto the porch and said, here, Hank, take this. I know it's expensive to have a girlfriend these days. Hank took the money without smiling and barely said thank you. He started down the stairs, and his father called after him, your mother and I want you to have fun, Hank.